once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this August 5th.
Yes,
of
it is.
2017. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Yes. If it's August 5th. If it's not August 5th.
It is the 5th of August. Yes.
That's good. August. That's cool. Hey, hot news.
Oh, really?
40 years ago this month, Voyager 1 and 2 were launched.
Very with the times.
And 5 years ago, Voyager 1 left the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
It passed the heliosphere boundary and is now in interstellar space. Voyager 2 is coming up on the edge of it and feeling it right now. And it is different out there. It is different out there than we thought it was.
How often are they communicating without? I mean, they're solar.
They're not
energy.
Solar. No, they're running.
Wouldn't work.
No, they're running off of a decaying atomic reactor that will, within the next 10 years, stop working. Their transmitter uses the same power as a 23-watt light bulb.
Hmm.
And they are transmitting continuously. We only have about NASA's only allocating a very small budget to them right now, so they only have like a 2 to 4 hour window per day that we listen. But they're transmitting continuously. But they're transmitting continuously from
a long ways away.
10 billion and 13 billion miles away. They are the first interstellar spacecraft, and what they found, and this is really geeky, but I think it's important, is when you get beyond the heliopause, it's caused, which is our sun puts out a pressure as it radiates outward, and that pressure creates sort of a bubble around the solar system that keeps interstellar radiation from hitting us. And that's one of the things we had theorized about, but when they got out there, they actually found it. Now that Voyager 1 is beyond the heliopause, it's discovering that there's these sudden waves of radiation that come sweeping across the galaxy. We're not even sure where they're from. We don't know very much about them except that they're intense and they come irregularly. And we never get to feel them here on the Earth, and if we did,
we'd all be fried.
We wouldn't feel them very long because we'd all be dead. And we discovered that interplanetary space is pretty deadly, so it's one of the reasons Orion, the new spacecraft, has got to have armored plating all over it. But we've discovered that interstellar space is even more deadly than that, which is an interesting discovery. The universe is just pretty darn hostile to life. And I think it's
good
amazing that some of the engineers that were there at the beginning, by the way, are still there. There's just a few of them left now, and a lot of them are deferring. So there's a bunch of really old guys.
Deferring?
They're deferring their retirement.
Ah, deferring retirement.
They're into their 70s in some cases, and they're still working
for
NASA.
They're the only ones that can talk to the spacecraft anymore.
And I just think it's one of those things where – frankly, I'm impressed. We built two spacecraft that we launched 40 years ago, and they're still working, and they're still talking back to Earth, and they made such astonishing discoveries that we just kind of assume today. They discovered that the moons around Jupiter and Saturn were not at all what we thought they were. They were completely different. One of them is basically mostly made out of water, which nobody guessed at. And they changed our whole view of the way the solar system works. And now they are altering our view of the way the rest of the universe works. And it's just quietly going on in the background, and it doesn't make the headlines, but it's nonetheless real. And it's nonetheless a testimony to our desire to explore the universe, that these we're still funding. Admittedly, our funding is a lot less than it used to be, but we're still funding the people and the equipment that's listening to these amazing pieces of technology. It's like a 17-hour lag time when you send the radio message to them. They're that far away. I just wanted to bring that up and say that there's things that the government has done and is doing that are really, really impressive, and I don't know that we are properly grateful for being the nation that's doing that.
You're going against our theme of grumbling about all things governmental.
I can grumble about something.
What are you going to grumble about?
Tax reform.
Oh, let me hit something else before you hit that, because it's something I've gotten a lot of questions on, and then I think tax reform is going to take a big chunk of our time, so I want to hit this first because I think it's important. I'm getting a lot of questions about Bitcoin and Ethereum and all the other cryptocurrencies out there. That's, if you don't know what that is, it's
good.
It's probably good. Cryptocurrencies are they're not really currency. The Treasury Department has ruled that they are not currency. They are a commodity, which is absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
A cryptocurrency is...
You have to mine for it.
What's that?
You have to mine for it.
Well, sort of. If you can, they call it mining, but really, it's just an algorithm that's being run. Lots of algorithms being run.
What's Al Gore got to do with it?
He's still inventing the internet.
Okay.
Okay. So, cryptocurrencies are a commodity. That's what the government is calling them. It's a good term for them. They're not a currency. You can't go to most places and buy something with them. You can buy things with them, but not very many places. A cryptocurrency's value is based on the fact that it's not part of a government. And two, it's backed by something presumably with value. Well, the thing that it's backed with is encryption. And when you log on to your bank account, the same encryption levels that are being used in the cryptocurrencies are being used and thrown away immediately, just valueless because it needs to be done every day. Every time you log into a secure website, you have a encrypted set of keys that are connecting your computer with the bank's computer. You put in your passwords. It sets all these keys in motion. And now you have an encrypted communication. Well, that encrypted communication is the base of the value of any cryptocurrency. That's it. Which means that as soon as this encryption can be cracked or a key is leaked, that Bitcoin is worthless. And that's something people have to understand. A lot of people get it and they say, okay, that makes sense. It's based on encryption. It's a security thing. If it's not secure anymore, it's worthless. Okay, that's the underlying foundation you have to hold. Between now and the next leap forward in technology, there's the possibility of making a lot of money in Bitcoins. There's a greater possibility of losing a lot of money in Bitcoins. Keep that in mind. It's gambling. You're not creating value here. You're trying to buy from one person so that you can hold it and sell it later at a higher value without creating anything in the middle ground. You're just holding on to it. That's a form of gambling. That's speculation. A normal investment, you buy it, you create some value in it if you expect profit. So those are key points to throw out there. The IRS is looking at the whole cryptocurrency world now with a much, much greater vigor. Keep this firmly in mind if you're going to go out there into the gambling world of trading cryptocurrencies. Because if you go to Vegas, another form of gambling, if you win big in Vegas, they give you a 1099. They tell you this is what your winnings are. In a lot of cases, they withhold taxes. If you then have a big loss at Vegas, they tell you, here's your loss amount, and you can report that to the IRS too. That doesn't happen with cryptocurrencies. If you make a lot of money and they can find any place that you did, even if you lost all that money later, if they can show that you made a lot of money and you didn't pay taxes on it, that's how they got Al Capone. It wasn't cryptocurrency, though. It was taxes. Remember that. There is no institution out there, Bitcoin or cryptocurrency related, that is under obligation to give you tax forms for your gains. If you think you're ever going to be audited, you need to keep every piece of record if you're going to get into that dangerous, already dangerous world of cryptocurrency gambling. Okay, now we can go on to tax reform, since we mentioned the IRS so lovingly.
Well, there's a couple of things going on that I think investors should be aware of. It's not a political statement that I'm going to be making in any form. It's reported in the Wall Street Journal, among other places. And that is that Congress will have 12 working days when they return to raise the debt ceiling, or the Secretary of the Treasury said, we will basically stop paying on our debts. We'll stop, the United States government will stop on or about October 1st making the payments that are obligated by law, because it simply won't have any money. Technically, we've been out of money since March, and Congress hasn't dealt with it. But the leader of the most conservative faction in the House of Representatives, Representative Mark Meadows, has called for major tax cuts, or he will not support raising the debt ceiling. And the major tax cuts are to corporate taxes. He wants to lower them below 20%. Which is certainly something that economically is a good idea, to lower corporate taxes down to the point where we become competitive internationally, which will bring a lot of money home. The problem is that would trigger a huge budget deficit as soon as it was enacted. Now, the argument could be made that, okay, if they bring the money home and we charge 10% on the money they bring home, for example, that it will make it up. Well, it will only make it up one time, and it might not even make it up that one time. The border adjustment tax has been dropped from the House of Representatives' consideration. That would have paid for a cut in the corporate income tax. Steve Bannon has suggested raising the top marginal tax rate to 44%. Unfortunately, that wouldn't generate enough revenue to cover the cut in corporate taxes. Now, there's the argument that if you lower taxes, then economic activity will speed up and we'll get more income. Well, we've already been there when George W. Bush asked Congress to lower taxes, they did. And we actually probably crossed the Laffer point, because revenues didn't go up, they went down. Now, it's hard to nail that down, because we were having a recession. But even when we came out of the recession, even without considering the fact that we're running a couple of wars off the books, the total revenue dropped when we dropped taxes, which means that, okay, taxes probably in the 90s were about where they needed to be. The difficulty is, if we get a government shutdown over this issue, then it is going to have an effect on the stock market and on the bond market and on a lot of other things, but I strongly believe it will be temporary, and at some point in the not-distant future after that, people will come to their senses, and they will realize, people that we have elected will come to their senses, and they'll realize that that won't work, and we'll go back to a sensible position. On the other hand, I don't think there's actually any chance of the House and the Senate approving, with the margins that are required, the 60-vote margin, a massive increase in the deficit. But I just want to let you know this is coming, and there's only 12 days. In other words, the Congress, when they return after this recess, will have 12 working days, and this is what they've got to do, to pass first a budget and then an increase in the tax ceiling. Now, we haven't even talked about tax reform yet.
Right. We're just talking about passing a budget. That's something that's supposed to happen every year, and we're looking at it with this much trepidation as to whether or not it's going to happen.
Miracles are always possible. It is entire, but right now the factionism without right now we could use a Ronald Reagan, or we could use
even a Bill Clinton,
or a Bill Clinton.
Anybody that can come in and
right.
smile a little bit and cause people to go, oh, okay, let's work together.
Right.
Even Bill Clinton got impeached, but he worked across the aisle.
Yeah,
NAFTA got signed on his watch, and I realize people go, oh, NAFTA. Most Republicans go, NAFTA's horrible. NAFTA was a Republican deal. Keep that in mind. He worked across the aisle.
It is. it's going to take bipartisan agreement to get a budget through, to get the debt ceiling raised, and then to move on to the tax reform that we so desperately need. And it's going to take a lot of compromises. And frankly, the last tax reform, and I've mentioned this before, but it's worth paying attention to, under Ronald Reagan, the Tax Reform Act of 1986 started in 1983. He began to work with Democrats and with Republicans in 1983 in order to get a Tax Reform Act passed in 1986. And I think they were working together quite reasonably well during that period. Don't expect miracles on the tax front. B, we could be in for some short-term volatility in the markets and in the economy if we don't raise the debt ceiling on time.
All right, and we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, and please forgive my ignorance. But I remember, I can't remember the guy's name, but the MSNBC has a finance guy that used to talk a lot about bringing money back into the United States from corporations that mm-hmm. are parked overseas.
Right.
And I think, I don't remember what he was going to reduce, but if you reduce that, money would come flooding in. And
yeah, right.
He wanted to reduce the corporate tax rate. The problem is the United States has the highest corporate tax rate of any developed nation. So corporations tend to keep their money overseas so they don't have to pay taxes on it in the United States. But we also have the lowest individual tax rates in the developed countries. And very frankly, if you're going to cut corporate taxes as much as we need to cut them to make this happen, you got to raise revenue somewhere else. And that was what the border adjustment tax was until the Walmarts and everybody else said we would just have to raise our prices 20%, and the people who shop at Walmart are lower income people. So what you're saying is you're going to cut corporate tax rates by raising the cost to the lowest income people in the United States, and somehow at some point they figured out that didn't work.
There a laugher on that as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Wouldn't there be a laugher point?
But we've already passed it.
Yeah, and here's the thing, and before we go any further, you mentioned this, but let me throw this out there. The laugher point is the point on the revenue generation for the government where – if you look at the curve that the point rests on, if you have 0% taxes, you have zero revenue. No money's coming in because you're not charging any money to anybody. If you have 100% taxes, you would think, well, everything is coming in. All the money goes to the government, you know, except that doesn't work.
Now, that's a simplified Democrat tax return.
Right. How much money did you make? Send it.
Right, send it in.
The problem with that is it doesn't work because nobody does it. Nobody sends in that much money. They need to live. You need to eat. Just ask the Soviet Union how that works out. You get this massive black market. You have missing things throughout the economy. There are things that are no longer created because the taxes are too high. So that means somewhere in the middle, if we recognize that the government needs some revenue, somewhere in the middle is the sweet spot, the point at which if you raise taxes beyond it, you lower the revenue. And if you think about a sandwich at a restaurant, if it's a really nice sandwich and it's a good location, you may be able to charge $20 for that sandwich in San Francisco.
Yeah, but not in Texas.
If McDonald's tried to charge $20 for a sandwich, unless it was a really crazy new something or another, people would not buy that sandwich. But you would think raising prices would raise revenue. Not true. At some point, you've got to find the right price for the sandwich. In taxes, it's become so complicated to look at the Laffer curve because there's not one Laffer curve. There's about 40. And there's probably a lot more than that if you get to the nitty-gritty of all of the tiny little taxes out there, the taxes on gold and on oil and on – there are different sets of taxes, whether or not you're married, whether or not you have the alternative minimum tax. All of those things mean that we don't have the ability to simplify raise or lower tax concepts. You can't say if we raise taxes, what happens? So I can break that down for the capital gains tax. When Obama raised the capital gains tax with the Affordable Care Act. It was affordable to some people and more expensive to others. So affordable may be a
yeah, but that's
funny
what
term.
Called.
That's what it's called. The The Affordable Care Act was passed. It tacked a 3% surcharge to capital gains for people that were making $200,000, or if you were married, $250,000, and revenue went up, which means on the capital gains side, we're really, really close to the Laffer point, because it didn't go up by 3%. It only went up by like a 1%, which means we may be just over the Laffer point, but we were far enough below it that we raised revenue anyway. So each of those points is not being looked at through that lens. It's being looked at through a political lens. The complexity is as much a problem as the raising or lowering of taxes. You mentioned this earlier in the last hour, that the big tech companies have about $1 trillion in cash and cash-like items sitting overseas that they're not going to bring over here because they'll wind up paying pretty close to 40% taxes on it.
Right.
And they don't want to do that. So if we were to lower – this is what the caller was talking about. If we were to lower that corporate tax rate and they brought all that money back, if we lowered it to, say, 25%, well, we'd get $250 billion right away. That's a big deal. That's not a little thing. It's a big deal. That's a quarter of $1 trillion that would come back.
That's presuming
that they brought every penny back.
They brought every penny back. But we actually have to go down to 20% or below to get them
right.
Back.
Right. It may be closer to 17% to get them back. But right. That's still $170 billion, again, presuming that they brought it all back.
Mm-hmm.
Then what?
That's a drop in the bucket in the federal budget.
Right. That is one moment in time. Now that we've got that influx, it may mean that they'll bring it back over time. But this is a decade-long pooling of money, more than a decade. They have been doing this for a long time, going, it's too expensive to bring it back. That means it's a trickle after that big flood. And it may be nice to solve one emergency budget issue, but it's not a long-term plan. We got to simplify the tax code so that we can even see where we should lower or where we should raise. It's not being looked at logically, and that's a statement of purely obvious because government's doing it.
the statement that the White House and the Republican leadership came out with last week said they're going to lower both corporate and individual tax rates. And then they gave some general guidelines.
You can't – well, you could, but we would have to cut the budget a lot.
They actually would wind up raising tax rates for people who made – couples who made between 100 and 300 and over 150 and less than 400,000 or something like that, which, by the way, unfortunately would hit a lot of small businesses right between the eyes.
Right.
And it's not that the owners of the small business actually pocket that money. It's just the way the tax code is set up.
Right. And basically, this is exactly what the point is, what we're saying here. The whole system is set up to tax on an annual basis. And we've mentioned this in passing. It's really complex. We do have a business. We have a business. And we're intending to put a big capital expenditure into the business. We need to buy a big machine, or we need to
hire somebody
or add a foundation for another building or something. Hiring somebody is a big one. And we say, all right, we need to have a certain amount of reserves in place so that we know that we can make payroll over all the months that, you know, if income fluctuates during that time period, we still need to pay a new hiree. So we build up this pool of cash, and the government taxes it immediately in that year, even though we may be using it the following year as a down payment or a signing bonus or whatever to somebody coming on.
And there's another big factor. When you start a business, you borrow a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then you pay off the debts gradually over time. And once you reach a mature point, and a lot of businesses are there today where – every time they make a payment on the debt on their building or whatever, they're actually – it's a lot more principal than interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's not deductible, and yet they don't get to spend it. It's money that comes in revenue, goes right out the door to the bank, and they still had to pay tax on it.
Now,
so,
they didn't have to pay taxes on the loan that they got.
But they had to pay. But we have to pay taxes when we start paying off loans.
Right.
And across the board, small businesses are doing something interesting. They're paying off their loans while large corporations are making more and more loans because it's tax advantage to do so.
Right. And when we talk about those big tech companies that have money sitting overseas, Apple's an example. We mentioned them last hour. Apple has about I looked up as I was looking, about 180, if you put it all together, and probably closer to 150 that are that's sitting over
150 billion.
Billion.
Right.
Sitting there. They've been paying dividends. They have been hiring people, and if you know anybody that works at Apple, you know that their contracts are really nice. They're very comfortable. And that's because Apple has released a bunch of bonds, 100-year bonds even. And they're using the cash that's sitting overseas as collateral on that bond. You can see a problem here.
Apple has $150 to $180 billion sitting overseas in short-term liquid positions.
Right.
They also have borrowed $100 billion at very low interest rates in the United States.
Based on that collateral.
Based on the fact
that they're Apple.
That they can do it, and it's very, very low interest. And that's one of the strange things that's going on right now. But tax reform should address the fact that we're running up unnecessary debt at the corporate level.
Right.
Because the tax rates on corporations are too high. But the only way, and this is something that would be very politically unpopular, the only way to lower revenue generation taxes on corporations is to raise it on individuals. And you can do it backdoor, like border adjustment tax means that individuals who shop, and I'm using this generically, who shop at Walmart would see about a 20% rise in the prices at Walmart. And that 20% rise in prices would actually go to the government, you know, and you could say, well, no, we didn't raise taxes on low income people,
except
for the fact that you did. And your price of a car would go up significantly.
There are solutions here, and the solution, and this is pie in the sky, the solution, but it's still a solution. If we were to go across the board, and this is something people don't really recognize, Reagan didn't lower taxes.
It was revenue neutral, right?
It was revenue neutral.
It just
simplified it. And by simplifying it, it was supposed to be revenue neutral, but in the process became extremely revenue positive because it was a lot easier to do the taxes. Right now, if I have to wait till October to file my taxes because I work for – I own part of the business, and the business has to file its taxes first, and then they have to figure out what part of that came to me, and we give these special forms. It's becoming more and more normal for people to have to file later and later. We get better and better technology to think things through, but we've made the complexity of the tax code, it's going faster than Moore's Law. The complexity is coming up faster than the technology to keep up with it.
The problem is everybody has their sacred cow. And
right.
And
mortgage interest.
Special tax
charities.
Deduction. And when you look at the ones that politically – the president, and he's the only one who's made clear statements on this, have put off limits to touch, you suddenly realize there's nothing left. And it would take a complete tax overhaul to so confuse – and I hate to say this – to so gore everybody's cow.
Right.
That we would all be equally unhappy.
Everybody would have to be equally upset in order for us to have some simplicity. I think it's worth it to get everybody equally upset.
Well, I think it's a necessity. We basically have to go in and do a complete tax overhaul. And when Reagan's Tax Reform Act of 1986, and it's called Reagan's for a good reason, he and his economic team at the White House described it, says, here's how I want to see it, and they negotiated it through the Senate and the House.
Helped write it. They were the ones that had the paper with the writing on it. Right now, it's being done completely in Congress with the president. It's very much like the Affordable Care Act. When Obamacare went through, Obama didn't write it. He told Pelosi, you do it. Whoa, I'm hearing some arcing.
Yeah, well, it's
electrical arcing going on.
Yeah, it's the electrical system. Anyway, hopefully it's not going to blow up.
I hope so.
The point is that when he did that by lowering the corporate tax rate to 28%, which is the maximum tax rate at the time, he lowered our tax rates in the United States to a lower level than the rest of the world had. And we gained a corporate advantage during that period. Since then, the rest of the developed world has raised individual tax rates and lowered corporate rates to the point where we're no longer competitive. So we can't do a Reagan-esque, everything's neutral, everything will work out well the way that we could before. The issue is this time around, if we really want corporate tax rates down at 17%, 15% is what President Trump campaigned on. 20% is what the House suggested in their early shot at this. If we really want corporate tax rates that low, and I do think we need to have them that low, then the rest of us have to recognize that we will have a higher income tax rate. We will lose deductions and or see higher marginal rates. Now, that's not a popular thing to do, but frankly, I said this last week, I'll say it again. We're running a deficit this year around $500 billion, which is too high. Lowering taxes, and by the way, the same people in the Freedom Caucus who were willing, some of the same representatives who voted to shut the government down in 2011 because the deficit was too high, have said they're willing to shut the government down to cut taxes without raising revenues, which raises the deficit. I don't get that, but I'm sure they have a good rationale behind it.
There is a rationale, and it's the rationale that has been there since the first Bush tax cuts. It was a good statement. The first Bush tax cuts were they lowered capital gains, and they got rid of the estate tax for a 10-year period. That raised revenue.
Yes.
We were above the Laffer point.
Right.
So they're still locked into the idea that if you lower taxes, you raise revenue.
I think you're locked into the idea that if you lower taxes, it'll make the voters happy and you'll get more votes.
Right. But it's kind of like saying, back to that sandwich analogy, every time you lower the price of the sandwich, you get more money. No, at some point you lower it too far. And right now we're in a place where there's a lot more complexity in the system. The tax code itself is more complex. The way the budget works is more complex in that the source of revenue is spread out all over the place. It's unfortunate that changing the price of the sandwich, in this case, because of complexity, changed the price of the sandwich, and we don't know what the impact is on overall taxes. Because that sandwich is mixed in with all the other super meals that are being ordered at the same time. You can't tell if lowering the price of that sandwich made you more money.
Yeah, well,
because there's too much complexity.
And the sandwich in this case is the government that we ask for and right. We have demanded, including defense,
Social Security, Medicare,
right.
Health subsidies. These are all things that were passed democratically. The majority of the people at least elected the people who made the decisions. So if we as a nation say we want these things, but we're not willing to pay for it, so let's get debt and obligate future citizens to pay for it, well, I think that's a problem. And then when we say, hey, we don't want any more debt, but we already ate the sandwich, but we don't have any other money except the debt to pay for it, that's the debt ceiling debate. There's not a lot of logic going on here. There's a lot of politics.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, and I think we probably ought to do some commercials.
That's a good idea. We'll do some commercials.
Better to do.
We just have to talk if we weren't going to play commercials.
All right.
We'll be back on the other end. Again, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. and telephone number to call in here, 254-773-1400. Let's see. I was looking for an article here that indicated that some point...
What was the subject of the article?
The subject was that the tax reform and the things that are coming up could be really there is a law on the books that the Congress passed and the president signed, unfunded tax cuts. In other words, if there was unfunded tax cuts, and we had tax cuts and tax reform,
mm-hmm.
Let's just say that the Freedom Caucus gets its way, and we get tax cuts, the corporate tax rate is lowered, nothing else is done, and they vote to raise the debt ceiling.
Okay.
The law says the difference has to come out of Medicare.
Okay.
That will be real popular.
Not at all.
Just thought I'd tell you, that was in The Economist, and I thought, whoa, I don't think the members of Congress who say, who cares about the deficit, just lower taxes on corporations, are aware of the fact that they passed a law about 5 years ago that said if we cut taxes in such a manner that it raises the deficit, then the difference between the two is cut out of Medicare, which is a suicide pact. It's a poison pill.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's going to happen.
Congress quite often writes poison pills into the things so that they can obligate future Congresses to their decisions today.
And then future congresspersons don't bother to remember that they passed that law.
Right. And then they are informed by it by some bureaucrat somewhere, hey, you've got to do this, usually at the last minute. And then they have to panic and run around in circles. That's another area of complexity. When the rulemaking system, this is we're really getting into politics here, but the rulemaking system that functions in the House and in the Senate is designed to help them remember what past Congresses said. When you pass a lot of laws and they have obligations associated with them, you're supposed to have the ability to catch up on them. So, for instance, the whole thing about reconciliation, where you don't have the filibuster on a budget item so that you can get it through with 51 votes instead of with 60 votes. That's so that you can pass a budget when we have a political environment like today. Only we're using it to not pass budgets. We're using it to try to change healthcare. Well, that's how the Affordable Care Act was passed. The Affordable Care Act was passed using a 51 vote system rather than a 60 vote system, and not a single Republican voted for it in the House or the Senate. If you use the rules that are designed to allow us to function better, to shut down the system or to get around complicated debates, we come up with really poorly designed laws. The Affordable Care Act, this is something that our current president, Trump, has said repeatedly. It fails if the executive branch doesn't, out of the goodness of its heart, allocate money to the states based on the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. And that's the reason why they had to make it the spirit of the law, is because it wasn't directly for that year's budget. So it would have required more votes to make it the letter of the law.
I hate to change the subject, but I'm going to anyway.
Well, don't hate it too much. We're talking politics.
This is from Financial Times of London. And they have a digital version called Fast FT that I get every day. And I didn't see this in either domestic publications or in publications in the state of Texas, but let me read you the first line. Texas manufacturing rose for a 10th consecutive month in July as the state's shale oil producers continue to hold ground. Wow. And general business activity, the index came in at 16.8. Zero is the balance point, where anything below zero, business is shrinking in Texas. Anything above zero, it's rising. June's was 15, and estimates were 13, but Texas came in at 16.8. That's 10 months now in a row that Texas has had positive manufacturing numbers. Factory production jumped to 22.8. That's 10 points higher than the previous month. And new orders and growth rate of orders is rising at 6.5 and 7.5% respectively. What that means is we can talk about the ills of the broader nation, and they're there, and we can talk about a lot of things, but something we're obviously doing something right in Texas. And it turned out the analysis from Financial Times was that the drop in oil prices in 2015, which, by the way, put Texas business into a recession, even though we didn't lay people off and even though the entire state didn't technically go into recession, we saw a shrinkage of business activity at the manufacturing level in the state of Texas in 2015. The manufacturers who saw that shrinkage realized that they had been making a lot of machinery for the oil patch. And this is a quote here. "We have found that manufacturing technology from the oil industry applies equally well to defense, aerospace, heavy vehicle manufacturing, and power generation." So what happened is, this is one of those wonderful things about the American enterprise system, which is why simple solutions generally don't work. And that is that a lot of manufacturers in Texas had employees, they had equipment. They had the ability to make amazing equipment, new equipment, and parts that were used in the shale exploration and fracking. And when all of a sudden that demand went away, they turned around and looked at aerospace and defense and a host of other areas and said, hey, the same skills, the same machining equipment we can use to become competitive on those contracts. And something wonderful about Texas and its non-union, its weird way of doing business.
No state
here.
Income tax.
Right.
Right.
Is employers didn't lay off their employees. Instead, they retooled, found new markets, and kept those skills on board. And that is something that is part of the culture of Texas.
Yeah, and I agree with that. This is something that it's hard to understand from outside of Texas, but if you take the entrepreneurial nature of the United States and really, really boil it down to the core values, that's what you find in Texas. Now, it doesn't mean we always make great decisions, but we're really good at fixing mistakes. We're really good at figuring out how to keep being profitable. The fact that oil prices dropped is the reason why it's profitable to have oil being developed at lower prices, because we retooled here. That's really important to understand. We have industrial capacity in Texas that's far higher than it used to be, and most people think, well, Texas isn't known for industry. It is. It's just it's not known in the same sense that Michigan was, and the industrial output of Michigan is now less than Texas by a massive amount. So just keep that in mind going forward. I was just looking at the Federal Reserve site, which is tracking the numbers that you were looking at there. And it's pretty amazing looking back at production capacity utilization. We've got a lot of growth coming in Texas. We're talking about 30% increases in production, 37% increases in production year over year. That's huge. These are numbers that you don't see in the rest of the country. And when you're going through the indicator direction, there are some decreasing areas. Let me count these real quick. Out of roughly 16, there's one decreasing indicator.
Which one is that?
Finished good inventories.
Oh.
Finished goods inventories.
Which means they'll have to be reordered later.
Well, no, this is an interesting factor. That's a number that's been going down with technology.
Right.
So it's just-in-time delivery. Right. If you're an oil company and you need a rig, it's going to be custom. It's going to be specific to your drilling, and that's part of the technology increase that makes it able to go forward so fast. So the company that made that rig doesn't say, I'll make five of those custom items and keep them on hand. They make the one. So the inventory on finished goods is lowering.
Let me throw in another positive here. I realize that those are not particularly popular, but with over half of the companies that have that make up the S&P 500 having reported their earnings, 73% have exceeded estimates. In other words, their earnings per share are higher than was expected. In this quarter, those earnings per share so far averaging up 6.4%. Now, that doesn't, and when I say 6.4%, that is an astonishing growth in a quarter. And if this, we saw that also happen in the first quarter. Now, how long that's going to go, I don't know. But across the board, the estimates right now, and again, I want to emphasize that corporations on the S&P 500 are beating estimates by the highest rate ever recorded so far. We're running at about a 9.5% earnings growth per year on average year over year right now. And that continues out into the future. That would indicate that the stock market still has a long ways to go on the upside, because the price to earnings ratio is not excessive right now. It traditionally it's averaged around 20. Forward price to earnings ratio, according to the Wall Street Journal, is about 18 point something. We figured a little lower than that, but it's still got room to grow as far as price to earnings are concerned. But the important thing is the earnings continue to rise. Another thing, and this is positive in every aspect of what's going on, the tsunami of regulations that restricted industry and business in general in the United States that we've seen in the recent past appears to have ceased. The issuance of new regulations has ground to a halt.
That is something that we can thank the Trump administration for.
Trump, and we also thank the Senate, because they've been very, very slow to confirm the limited number of nominees.
Right.
That's
not good in every case, but when we're already talking about massive overregulation, it's good in a lot of them.
And the other thing is, and I mentioned this in the newsletter, we saw imports rise slower than exports this last month and the last quarter. Part of that is the fact the dollar is falling. And you don't think this is a little crazy. One of the reasons the dollar is falling is because all of the turmoil that's coming out of Washington, D.C.
Right.
And the White House. In fact, that's sort of a plus, because that makes goods that we ship overseas less expensive and more competitive. So a weak dollar to a point. Now, there comes a point, of course, if the dollar goes down far enough where we import so much that it would cost a fortune import.
Yeah, the if you went to buy a television, but it would be more expensive at Christmas than it is today, which is a little bit backwards from what we're used to.
Even in inflation adjusted dollars, this last quarter and this last month were the highest on record for exports. We have the highest export level we have ever had in the history of the United States.
A big chunk of that is oil.
Right. Even if you take the oil out, we're doing extremely well.
Very well. Yeah.
But we are exporting oil for the first time. As a percentage of our exports is a small number.
Net exports of oil is huge, though. That means we are, in essence, energy independent. So it's been a goal for the Democrats and the Republicans for a long time. I wish they would stop every once in a while to pat each other on the back and say, we did it.
They're scared the other side might take credit for it.
Yeah, they really didn't do it. It was the business owners that did it.
Right.
But, you know, the lawmakers are supposed to stop and take credit for the business owners occasionally.
The commentators that I read and respect have uniformly at some point said the same thing. Despite everything that's happening in Washington, our economy seems to be doing just fine.
Right. And it may be kind of because of the gridlock in Washington. I'm quite glad that they've stopped doing things. I would really like them to stop doing. I would like them to roll back some of the intense complexity that they've already put in place. But if they're not adding more complexity, I'm happy. So I'm happy with the chaos in Washington at the moment.
And last but not least to me, we're almost out of time here. I've had several people say the market is peaked. Isn't the market too high? The answer is, among the people I respect, they're all saying, no, it's not. And the other thing is, all of that worry that you hear that the market is too high is a powerful signal it's not.
All right. When everybody is yelling the market can go on like this forever, that's when we get worried. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing headlines saying the opposite of that. That's good. Keep it up, headline writers.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do business managing wealth for people with a sufficient number of dollars to manage or investments to manage. And we have a local telephone number, and that is 254-947-1111.
And that has toll-free. We have toll-free to that same number. There's voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week. The toll-free is 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got our philosophy, our newsletter, our beautiful staff, are made for radio faces, and podcasts of this program and many others. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.